Globally, one in every eight people suffer from a mental disorder. Anxiety and depression affect people from all walks of life, all ages, all ethnicities, and we're here to talk about it.
This is the Quiet Chaos Podcast.
From anxiety to depression, from disorders to marriage, and everything in between, we're talking about it.
We're talking about it.
Bold, real, raw, and we'll have some fun. Let's do it. This is the Quiet Chaos Podcast. And now your host, author, therapist, international speaker, Jason R. Sullivan.
Welcome to the Quiet Chaos Podcast. This is your host, Jason Sullivan, and we are beginning a new series. This is a follow-up on trauma. We had three good episodes on trauma and a lot of fun, as much fun as you can have with trauma, I guess. But I wanted to follow this up with another a bit controversial topic when it comes to trauma, and that's forgiveness. So we're going to do a three-part series on forgiveness, and you might be a little surprised by how we go about it, because forgiveness is not necessarily being okay with what's happened. It's definitely not forgetting, but maybe it's a bit more. Maybe there's some sense of peace that comes with it. And so today, I have a great guest, Chris Dedona. He is a therapist, an entrepreneur, and he is in my hometown of Orlando. And so, Chris, welcome to the podcast. And I'm so excited to have you on.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. We got to tell them the truth, though. We've already been talking for 3 hours.
Right?
This worked out really well. We're a good match.
I think so, too. Being able to sit and really get to know each other more, a lot of shared interests. And I do think we have a lot in common. And so I was excited just to feel like just the way we were able to click. And so we did get 3 hours in before the episode, and it was a good 3 hours.
It was a good 3 hours.
Well, we're taking on this topic, man, forgiveness. There are a lot of definitions of it, a lot of ideas of, we should forgive and forget. That's one that I hear tossed around a lot. Just the word should, I think, is a bit dangerous with forgiveness because it becomes more of a guilt-driven thing. Now, you work in counseling. You work with people who have probably been through a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. And when you go to that point where you begin talking about forgiveness, like, what does that look like? I mean, how do those sessions unfold?
Well, I think it unfolds in a lot of different ways, but I'm struck by what you just said, forgive and forget, which you're right. I think a lot of people think that way. But in reality, we can't forget trauma. We can't forget things that have really impacted our lives because our bodies store that. And so I think a lot of times what happens in the counseling room is someone is trying to forgive or forget, or someone doesn't even know they've been harmed. Because they've buried trauma. They've buried a story for so long, they've begun to believe something that's not true about it.
And that sense of belief that comes by burying, do you think that's fueled by shame? Do you think that's fueled by fear? I mean, how does that connect?
I think it's the body doing its job. You know, if you think about if you're a child, and maybe there's people listening right now that, you know, they've been through some things. There's things that happened early on when they were children that were really harmful, whether someone did something to them or they were in a car crash or a terrorist attack, something I went through. Mm-hmm. And it's something you've been through as a kid and your body is trying to protect you. Mm-hmm. And so if you feel out of control, if things aren't in your control, it's the body and the brain try to forget something. But what happens is over time, you become an adult and you've never actually named the things that happened to you or named the harm that was done against you. And you carry things with you in the subconscious, and it eventually finds its way to the surface. And that's when people usually get to the counseling room, is when something's found its way to the surface.
And when you end up in the counseling room, I find it interesting a lot of times because, you do have clients who will come in, and even in the way that they process healing, it's more like going to a garage and talking with a mechanic. I want you to fix me. And I wonder sometimes even the mindset of being fixed, if that's tied somewhat to the trauma itself. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, wanting to be fixed is, it's a very, I don't know. I know you're in Kuwait, but for me, that's like a very Western idea of it's like we want it now, right? Mm-hmm. We want to be served now. We want entertainment now, right? We want to be fixed now. But unfortunately, it's just not the way the human body and mind and spirit work. Mm-hmm. It's a process. And I think a lot of the healing process that happens in counseling is letting go of control, releasing the reins. Yeah. Releasing the reins of control that you've been holding on, that your body, again, it's not that you're a bad person. It's that your body has been protecting you from being overwhelmed by trauma. You know, if you were that little girl, little boy that experienced something, it was so overwhelming that your body had to shut it down and create a different narrative so that you would survive.
I like
35.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that word you use, narrative. Narrative, we have always functioned on story. I mean, you go back to the Greek epics, you go to today, and this is something that I've talked about a few times on the show, but the stories are the same. I mean, you always have a hero that's been damaged. And the story is coming to terms with the damage, healing through the damage, and finding some sense of value in themselves that allows them to move forward. Now, I do think it gets a little dramatized. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, I don't know anybody that can fly. I wish I knew people with a bat cave. That would be amazing. But maybe one day, hopefully. But in reality, the importance of our narrative, I think, is it's a necessity to embrace. But mm-hmm. how that folds out when you've been traumatized, I mean, because we're not thinking in story when we're surviving. Mm-hmm. So how do you encourage people to begin to even look at their narrative?
I love that you're bringing up story. I mean, I was just explaining to you how I'm going back to my story right now. I'm trying to figure out, you know, am I in the plot? Am I in my own plot right now? Or have I taken a rabbit trail somewhere else? Right? Because we each have a story. And in any good story, there's, like you said, there's the hero. And he or she comes up against something that requires an adventure, right? It's like there's some kind of tension that if you're going to actually face the dragon, or go out, you know, and deal with what's happening, you got to set out on an adventure. And so you kind of see the counseling room as, in some people's story, it's an honor to be part of that adventure. They're finally facing the dragon and getting back to their story. And I completely forgot what you asked. So can you ask
Well, I mean, I love it because you answered it really well. I mean, like, yeah. But because the role of the narrative, or at least how we enter into seeing the value of our narrative, it's a very counterintuitive thing, because we've spent a bulk of years shutting down the narrative. It's a painful narrative, and like you said a bit earlier, that when we go through those things, our body does what it does and it shuts it down. And so the process of going into something that the body's shut down, that's a delicate process.
Yeah.
And so what are the early stages? Like when someone has come in, they've gone through trauma, and you see the value of their narrative, you see the value of their story. Mm-hmm. How do you begin to introduce them?
Yeah. So if you think about it, if you're making a film, you really have to identify the parts of the story to make any good. I imagine George Lucas, when he went in to make Star Wars, he had to actually write down, here's the main parts of the story, right? When you're thinking about your own story and any kind of harm you experienced, or even the good things you've experienced, naming those things is so important. Mm-hmm. Because in the act of actually naming something brings it back to life. If something's mm-hmm. been buried for many years, getting in front of someone who's safe and who's non-judgmental and who's kind, being able to bring your stories out into the open and name what those stories actually were, I think that's the first step. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you bring George Lucas up because every story has a villain. And maybe it's unintentional, but Lucas goes with the dark side, which is kind of Jungian in its principle. Facing the dark side, overcoming it, being wounded by it, finding out that you're so enmeshed with it that you don't realize, and then having someone guide you through this. Now, obviously, your therapist shouldn't be someone that's really short and green. But well, I mean, if your therapist is short and green, I mean, that would be a plus. I mean, like if you got Yoda, you really can't do better. But facing the dark side of ourselves is not always the evil side of ourselves, but sometimes it's the hurt side of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so demystifying the darkness, putting a name to it, the dark side wasn't enough. It had to have a figurehead. And so you have Darth Vader, and Darth Vader is literally the embodiment of the dark side, to the point that he wears all black and really is the voice encouraging Luke to come to the dark side.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt the fact that he was an abusive father who abandoned his son either. You know, so there is some trauma tied to it. Lot of trauma, actually. But the process of healing and understanding our narrative, it's a powerful, powerful thing.
Yeah. And we're only talking about Luke Skywalker right now because he had to overcome something. Mm-hmm. And we don't want bad things to happen to us. I mean, no one would want that. I mean, you wouldn't be a good person if you wished, harm on people. But the thing is, this is what leads to a good story, mm-hmm. And so I don't, there's parts of my story that I wish never happened, but now that they have happened, instead of burying them forever, I can name them and see this as a challenge. Really, like this is part of my story. How am I going to use this to see good happen through my life? Mm-hmm. But you don't get there easily. I'm jumping way ahead right now, right? Like first you got to name it and then you got to process. You have to process the story, right? Luke went on a journey.
Yeah, he did. And it's interesting because when you look at most heroes, Batman, Superman, they all had to deal with family wounding. They had to deal with who they are as individuals, what their place is in the world, how to deal with anger. I think that's more Batman specific. But all of that played a role in the end. It helped them define their purpose and it changed the course of their purpose, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in my own story right now. I think a theme that comes up in the beginning of my story is feeling constricted. Feeling like I lived in a prison, a metaphorical prison in a lot of ways because of family issues and emotional issues and trauma. And then coming out of that, like moving away to Orlando at 18, becoming an adult and experiencing so much freedom, right? And so this becomes, this idea of freedom then becomes a theme in my story. And I kind of see this play out over time.
The process of overcoming. When we're traumatized, we experience the pattern of trauma. When you mentioned the subconscious, like 40 to 90%, depending on which research you go with, but between 40 to 90% of our subconscious and limbic functioning relies on routine and pattern. If that trauma has existed to a point that it's become routine and pattern, our tendency is to begin to identify with it and to repeat it, which means that all of the sudden, over a period of time, we become our own abuser. Mm-hmm. And then when we begin to internalize that, and I don't think it's a conscious choice. I think that it's a very subtle thing that goes on, but it can be self-talk. It can be even our outlook on life. There was a study done, I think, in 2016, which people who had developed generalized anxiety disorder compared to social anxiety disorder had like pretty much zero optimism bias, that their brain had normalized hopelessness to a large degree. And so they continue to carry out the fear or the hopelessness that came with their trauma, but now they're in the driver's seat of it. Yeah. And so I would imagine that there's a lot of shame that's tied with living with a history of trauma.
Oh, yeah.
And probably some self-hatred too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a theme you see in the counseling room a lot. It's hard to watch, actually, because as a counselor, you really begin to care for people that are there with you. In a professional way, you really do start to feel honored that they're sharing their story with you, and you become very interested in their story. And to see people deal with something like trauma and have things done to them that were not right. I mean, really the definition of evil, they were impacted by evil, and to see them blame themselves for that is very difficult. And I think it's a common thing that people tend to blame themselves, because again, it's your body protecting yourself. It's something you can control. If you blame yourself, well, then you're in control of the situation. But if someone else was to blame and justice hasn't been brought, then the situation's out of your control.
Absolutely.
A lot to carry.
Yeah, because like you said, and I can't think of a better terminology for it, but control is a huge factor, and control through sabotage, you really can't mess that one up. You know, control as a means of succeeding in something, well, maybe. I mean, maybe you have 60, 70% of control there. But if I want to sabotage, or if I want to maintain a low sense of self, I can do that 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And if I've been given the tools of self-sabotage by someone who's traumatized me, well, not only am I equipped, but I'm motivated.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not trying to be the counselor or salesman here, but this is why therapy is so important. This is what changed my life and led me to be a therapist, is being able to sit in front of someone and to pull out the narrative that you're living in, right? Name the harm, name the things that have happened to you, name the things you find yourself in, and to have someone reflect back to me what they're hearing from me gave me new eyes for what I was experiencing. All the self-blame that I had for myself, this very trustworthy person was sitting in front of me and basically telling me, They felt so much emotion over my story, and they were so sorry that happened to me, and they were helping me realize none of this was my fault. That's just a story that I believed to help myself. Mm. And you know what? It's the body. It's not that we're bad people or that we're dumb or we're idiots, but it's just that is what the brain is trying to do. It's trying to protect us from harm, but eventually it turns into this self-blame thing that really ends up hurting us in the end. And really the only cure for that is sharing your story with safe people, people that can help you process and see what's true in that narrative.
There's an old book by Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray. And to me, I think this is one of the most powerful examples of long-term sabotage and fear. Dorian was a very attractive guy, and a painter wanted to capture his image. And so he pulls Dorian aside and says, you know what, I want to paint you. I want to make a portrait of you. And so Dorian begins to sit for the portraits. And as the painting goes on, Basil's friend, the painter's friend, comes in, and he's more the skeptic. He's more cynical, right? He's seen the darker sides of life. And he starts getting into Dorian's head a bit and, telling him, you should be out living. You should be out doing. You're young. And that fades away fast. And Dorian becomes obsessed with this idea. And his narrative begins to shift. And as his narrative begins to shift, the painter finishes the work and shows him, and Dorian's response is to cry. He weeps. And he says, oh my gosh, I'm older than the painting already. I've aged already. And this begins it's like a wish that Dorian makes, that I wish that this painting would age and I would stay the same. Mm. And so Dorian commits to this. It happens. And really quickly, Dorian becomes more and more cynical, more angry, darker. His actions shift. And the painting absorbs all of this. And it's the constant reminder. And he can't get rid of the painting, because if someone sees it, they'll understand everything that's happened. And so, not to spoil the story, but to spoil the story, towards the end, Basil's old and Dorian hasn't aged a day. And Basil is leaving I can't remember where he's going, but he's elderly and probably won't come back. So he came to see the painting one last time. And Dorian had hidden the painting as deep as he could. He hid it in a room, had covered it with a cloth, and he took Basil to the back. And he unveiled the painting because he wanted Dorian to see the painting. He wanted someone to know the dirt that had gone on. He wanted to be known. But at the same time, just as he had hidden the painting, well, Basil couldn't carry that story out anywhere else. And so he kills Basil. And as soon as he kills Basil, he's become the narrative that he hates. And so what he does is he takes the knife that he used to kill Basil and he stabs the painting. And in that moment, the painting returns to its original form, and he takes on all of the imagery, all of the scars and wounds, everything comes to the surface, to the point that when his maids came to find him, they found someone that they didn't recognize him.
Wow.
And so when you look at unattended trauma, it's that part of us that tries to separate ourselves from the trauma, to bury it. Mm. But underneath the surface, we want to be known.
Oh yeah. I love that wording, known. I mean, that's the freedom I experienced when I first started counseling. And it was like a addiction to being known at that point, right? It's like you share your story, you share your dirt, and someone reflects back to you love, care, and grace when you were expecting to be hated, or you were expecting to be looked at with shame. And it just became this liberating experience, right? And it's funny, you're bringing me back with that story of Dorian Gray. You're bringing me back to seventh grade literature. And that's all that little, yeah. I mean, that's all that middle school boy wanted to be, was known, right? And that's where I found a lot of my trauma. Not being known by anybody and not being cared for properly. And then to bury that in that trauma that I experienced around that time period, coming out in my body and back pain and all different types of things. And then the experience of being known was a liberating experience. And it's an experience I want to help give other people. And I imagine there's people listening right now who are terrified of going to counseling, and that's normal. Like if it wasn't important, it wouldn't be terrifying.
Absolutely. I like that.
Yeah.
facing that darker side of us, because we do internalize our trauma. At some point, we have trouble distinguishing ourselves from our traumatizer.
Yeah.
And I think being known is not just being known by another person, but also knowing ourselves.
Yeah.
And you can't do that in isolation. And it's just, we need some form of community around us. And like you said, counseling is a beautiful part of that process, because you're sitting with someone who has the experience of going down that journey with you, who has a high ethical standard of making sure that what you say stays with the therapist in the room. It doesn't leave. And yet we still fear being judged. You know, and once that happens, once you get past that point, like you said, you kind of get addicted to being known. It's a beautiful thing. I love your wording there, man. That's a great way of putting it. Now, if we move to the idea of forgiveness, in the middle of all of this, you know, our narrative has been changed. We've pushed things underneath the surface. We've established that we kind of become our continued abuser. What is forgiveness? How does that start, and how do you work that in?
I honestly don't think a majority of the time there's a moment of like forgiveness, like a switch goes off. I think over time, like you said, being known and experiencing love and grace and kindness towards our stories, we naturally start to be forgiving towards ourselves, and we start to realize, man, those things that happened to me weren't my fault. There's nothing I could have done any differently. But you know, maybe there are stories where you could have done something differently, right? And then still receiving kindness and care and compassion in response to those stories is healing as well. There's a famous line by one of my favorite musicians, Brandon Flowers. He's in a band called The Killers. And he says, "Give me the eyes that I may see the good in my people and the trouble in me." And I know we're talking about, you know, self-forgiveness too. But I think what happens is in the healing process, when you start to forgive yourself, then you start to see the good in others, and you're able to forgive others once you're able to forgive yourself and extend that same mercy. And then it comes all the way back around where, you know, a lot of times in our culture, or at least in American culture, there's this almost like it's like me against the world, right? That's also unprocessed trauma.
Absolutely.
That's really like a form of self-hate. It's like isolation. It's like, I'm good, everyone else is terrible, right? Which is really the same thing. When you get down to it in the counseling room, it's just an opposite reaction of, I'm terrible, everyone's better than me. And I think that's what he's saying in that song. It's like, give me the eyes that I may see the good in my people and the trouble in me. This is someone who's done their work. Absolutely. You know, this is someone who's humble and has dealt with a lot of their own pain.
And recognizing the trouble in me, even that, there's this distinction of my trouble is not necessarily that I'm bad. My trouble may be the experiences that I've gone through have internalized and have maybe distorted my narrative. You know, because to keep a narrative of trauma going, there always has to be someone creating the trauma. And you said this really well, that if that dichotomy of the rest of the world is bad and I'm on my own, you've literally begun to create a world of abandonment and isolation. And we're wired. I mean, our mirror neurons, our need for oxytocin, we're wired for connection. We're wired for intimacy. And now we have this self-imposed wall that keeps us stuck and isolated. Yeah. And so the trouble in us, I think, sometimes is not necessarily that, you know, we are a bad thing. Maybe we did some things, okay? I mean, we've all done some things, all right?
Yeah.
But understanding that narrative and recognizing the pain that we've been through and the hurt that we've been through really does paint those presuppositions in a way that limits how we even see our choices.
And so
I love this. I love your idea, your thought process, because that unfolding narrative just really does come across as a vital part. Understanding your story seems like a very vital part of growth and healing.
Yeah. You know, I had a situation with a friend in 2016. We rented an RV in Anchorage, Alaska, and drove it all the way to Toronto, which was probably, I don't even know, was like 8,000 miles. It was insane. But we drove through some of the craziest highways. It's like the Alaskan Canadian highway is not paved, most of it. And we're in an RV. So it was just like a really hard trip, and all of our stuff was coming out, right? Like we were just like pushed to the edges of exhaustion, pushed to the edges of adventure. There's like bears, like squirrels outside the, well, I don't know. I don't know if the listeners have squirrels outside their house, but in Florida, squirrels outside of there. But there were just bears everywhere. We were just on edge. It was an amazing adventure, but there was a lot of stuff was coming out. And the final explosion was, I think it was like in the middle of the night. It was my turn to put gas in the RV, and I opened the gas tank and I start pouring gas in. But then I realized I poured gas in the water tank.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. So we're already on edge, and I have to go back into this RV and explain to these guys that I just put gas in the water tank. It did not go over well. There was lots of yelling, lots of screaming, lots of arguing. We, you know, it took us 4 years to recover from that. So, you know, I think about that, and there was a lot going on in my own story outside of that, where I was harboring a lot of unforgiveness towards myself, which made it really hard in that situation to recognize the ways I played into that situation and to offer forgiveness to my friend. And I found out later he was going through the same thing.
Oh, wow. You know,
he was doing the same thing. And in 2020, we ended up reaching out to each other. I forget who was the first to reach out, but it just kind of happened naturally. And I'd say he's in the top five closest friends in my life right now. Because we had this experience of a really traumatic thing happening. It was actually a lot of little traumatic things, but this one big traumatic thing being that we no longer had water on our trip in the middle of the wilderness, you know?
Oh my goodness.
But you know, when I think about forgiveness, I think about that story. It's not this clean narrative where it's just like forgive and forget. Right. This was complicated. There was a lot of things that went into this, and it took two people processing their own stories on their own to be able then to come together. And instead of pointing the finger at one another, being able to say like, I played a part in this too, you know, and I hope that you would forgive me. And then also offering forgiveness for the ways they played a part, played a role in the mess as well.
That coming together and connecting, experiencing perspectives in each other's story. That's a powerful thing. And when you internalize that, it seems like, and correct me if I'm off on this, but those two sides of us, the traumatized and the part that's driven to continue the pattern of traumatizing, both share the same hurt. It's that one is feeding a cycle, like you said, of control, and the other one is accepting the abuse, the internalized abuse, as a means of control. And so when you start connecting those sides, I would imagine that there is a coming together moment where, just like as you were saying, you sit down and you realize, wait, we've both been dealing with the same stuff. Oh, I'm losing you. I think,
I'm
are
sorry,
you there?
You're breaking up a little bit.
I'm not sure what's going
on. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. It says my internet is unstable. It probably needs therapy. So this connection that you were talking about with your friend in the trip, I mean, it sounds like a rough trip. I mean, it sounds like one of those, like,
Well, it's one of those amazingly rough trips. It's like good memories, but also some of the worst memories.
That's usually a connecting trip right there. Good and bad. But in that, you know, the two sides of you, for your friend, for you, like you both had to have time to heal. You came back to the table and you reconciled.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish. You can finish your thought.
Well, you know, when you look back at the history or ideology backing forgiveness, you know, there's the development through the Greco-Roman world where prostes was a term that was used for forgiveness. This is the Attic Greek. And prostes was about appeasing anger, but also reconciling. And so when we talk about forgiveness, there's the angry side of us on both sides. The internalized abuser is angry. The part of us that's been wounded is angry. And the idea is reconciling the two.
Yeah.
And so we experience prostes in forgiving. So it's not so much you did a bad thing, I'm writing it off. It's more, I'm really angry. I'm really, really angry, and this hurt, and we need to reconcile the wounding.
That's really good. Yeah, because it's going back to what you said in the beginning. It's like forgive and forget. Well, that doesn't work, especially when there's people involved, and we're all people. And so in this situation, I mean, there was some real serious hurt on both sides. I was hurt in this situation. I mean, let's name the hurt in this specific situation. I was ashamed of a mistake I made, and then going back in the RV and receiving brutal anger directed at me when I'm already angry at myself. I mean, there was zero mercy, you know? And so for me, that was really hurtful and really damaging to our relationship. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that I contributed to that though, in different parts of the trip, a lot of anger that I expressed unfairly towards some of the guys I was with. And part of forgiveness is releasing of it's almost like chains. It's like if unforgiveness is like being stuck to a prison cell, right? So actually Henry Nouwen says to forgive another person from the heart is an act of liberation.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. Oh, it's man. So if you see forgiveness as not something you're just supposed to do and forget, no. An act of liberation is a special thing. Mm-hmm. It's a sacred thing. It's something that actually costs you something. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about like the Underground Railroad in slavery times in the United States, I mean, people, that was an act of liberation. People were actually liberating people from actual chains, and it cost them something. A lot of times it cost them jail time and their businesses, and the same forgiveness. It's going to cost you something because it is an act of liberation for you and the other person.
And on the internal level, that beginning or initiating start of forgiveness is liberating both sides of ourselves, but it also sabotages our coping strategies as a cost.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that how we've been doing life doesn't work anymore. And that shifts back, I think, into a whole different topic of grieving the process or grieving process of our trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And continually reconciling, because as we grieve, things come to the surface and our old tendencies, our old ways of coping and dealing, whether it's self-blame, whether it's isolation, see those options come to the surface because we feel out of control. And I think this is where the importance of community comes in.
Oh, absolutely.
That we begin to learn from others how to forgive ourselves, just like we learn from the abuser how to abuse ourselves. We're just experiencing the liberation of connection.
Yeah. And so if you think about it in terms of You know, there's probably someone listening who's like, well, how do I actually go about this? Like, what are the actual steps to going about this? And the reality is we need to find safe people. We need to find people who are merciful and kind. And that's hard. It's easier said than done. Right. And that's why counseling for me was so important in the beginning, was paying someone who is that way, you know, to almost teach me how to process my own stories and find the people, the right people to do that in my everyday life with friends.
Absolutely. And I think that you look at any form of education, there's tuition, and we don't think about that. I mean, we will throw down loans left and right to finish a degree. And that helps shape our mind and prepares us for our career. It prepares us for our future. But for a lot of people, the idea of paying to learn about ourselves or paying to understand our brokenness, that gets deprioritized. And I wonder how much of that is based on that overall sense of neglect that trauma brings.
Yeah. So you mean like not taking care of yourself the way you would take care of other things in your life?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's not pragmatic. You know, it's not like, you know, it's not two steps and you're fixed. It's like you said, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And that process is tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's kind of like, if you think about someone who, there's a type of person, there's always this type of person that comes in that wants to help everyone else before ever taking care of themselves. And it's kind of like that cliche of, you know, you're on an airplane and the oxygen masks come down. I mean, hopefully this doesn't happen for anyone, but you know, if it did, it's like, if you don't put on the oxygen mask and take care of yourself, you're going to pass out and not be able to take care of anyone else. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah, people can survive for a little bit ignoring these important stories in their lives and the stories of harm and unforgiveness and forgiveness and all these types of things. But eventually it will catch up to you and you won't have the oxygen anymore to be the person you want to be in the world and help other people.
And it's ironic because when you buy a ticket and you get on an airplane, part of that ticket goes into paying a salary for someone to walk you through the process of what to do if calamity happens.
Yeah.
Every flight I've ever been on, the same speech. If you lose cabin pressure, the mask will fall from the ceiling. And so it's reinforced on every flight. We have to be reminded. Mm-hmm. And you have a person standing in front of you, walking you through the process. It's a little irritating because sometimes it disrupts the movie that you're watching already on the runway. But the importance of being reminded that in our calamity, that one, we're in it together, that there's a process established, and that if the worst case scenario happens, it's not necessarily the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're so much more equipped. I mean, this is probably a terrible analogy, though, to go down, because I don't know if anyone's surviving, you know, a plane crash, but we're so much more equipped because I've heard that spiel a million times.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Right. I know that there's people teaching me what to do in case of emergency. I know what to do. But I know for a lot of people, they haven't been given the tools for trauma. Mm. Honestly, this is a new thing in the last 30, 40 years. I mean, we didn't know much about what caused harm to people's brains and bodies from a trauma perspective. But now we know. And we know that an important part of that is processing what's happened to us, and which gives us then the ability to release people and to release ourselves through forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful thing, that sense of reconciling and dealing with the anger. I mean, when we look at forgiveness in those terms, it's learning to have peace. It's learning to mm-hmm. experience peace in a heart that's been at war for a long, long time.
Yeah.
This is exciting. I think we could talk for hours, man. I love your perspective on this. And I think our listeners will absolutely love this. We need to have you back on soon. This is
would love that, man.
Definitely, because this is I just on a selfish level, I've enjoyed learning from you in this, and yeah. So we definitely need to do this again soon.
It's been awesome being here, man. And you told me that one of the biggest cities of listeners is Miami, so I'm always happy to be on because that's my hometown.
Mm.
I'm a gringo from Miami. I'm a white guy from Miami. But I love it. I love that place. Grew up in Hialeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Miami and the surrounding areas. It's a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
And now you're in Orlando, man. This is...
I know.
And I don't know if you're a basketball fan, but I'm watching the Magic. I pull for the Magic, and they're doing well this year. They're starting to come together, and it's an exciting time.
I live like literally 2 miles from the basketball arena, but I've never been an NBA fan. I'm a huge college basketball fan.
Okay. Fair enough.
But I think I need to get into it because I live so close now. I need to just start going to some games.
Oh, it's addictive. You'll love it. If you like basketball, but just being there is it's an exciting thing.
I gotta do it.
Yeah. So if you do, let me know and we can Zoom call and I can watch the game with you. So
okay.
but man, it's really been a pleasure. And thank you so much. Your insight is just brilliant. So
yeah.
Great stuff.
Thanks for having me on, Jason.
Definitely. And guys, thank you so much. I say this every episode, but it's so true. Your messages, your emails, you guys send some great stuff. We have some good guests coming soon. We're going to continue this two-part series. And then we have, in a few weeks, we're going to have an author come on who is in the process of releasing a book. And it'll be a lot of fun. It'll be something that I think will cap off the process and journey of pain, struggle, and forgiveness. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to going through this series with you guys. But keep the emails coming, and we will see you next week. But until then, this is Jason signing off.
You've been listening to the Quiet Chaos Podcast.
Our passion is to talk about anxiety, depression, and disorders, and answering tough questions, but having fun doing it. Coming at you with facts, interviews, hard-to-discuss topics, and a little bit more rebellious than your typical mental health show. We hope you've enjoyed it. Make sure to like, rate, and review, and we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, hit us up on Instagram at QuietChaosKW. Remember, there is hope. Even when your brain tells you there isn't. See you next time on the Quiet Chaos Podcast.